Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
And welcome to episode 232 of Geek Time Radio. I'm back this week with Matt. How
are
you doing?
I'm good, David. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. This is probably going to be the last full show before the new year, I think, as we're getting to that sort of point. I don't think it's worth putting a full show out on the 23rd, and then we'll be off for Christmas and back on the 6th. So this will be the last kind of full show of the 2019, last show of the decade. So
yeah, wow, that's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're going to go through and do quite a big list of things to watch out for over the next few weeks at the end. So keep an eye out for that. But before we get to any of that, what have you been up to?
Been continuing watching Swamp Thing. I think the last time I came on, I'd seen two episodes, and then I got distracted by Lost in Space, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Right.
But I'm on episode, I think, 6 at the moment of Swamp Thing. It's pretty good. It's still managing to blend horror with, you know, comic books. I wouldn't really say superheroes because I wouldn't really call Swamp Thing a superhero, but the DC comic book type of show along with horror. I don't know if you might remember this, but obviously I won't really spoil it specifically. There's a very kind of violent scene or gory scene in episode 4, I want to say.
Right.
It's that infection plot line that they had.
Oh, right. Yeah. No,
sees that thing.
Yes.
And damages himself a lot. It's interesting with the swamp because it's when you sort of look at it in a basic sense, it looks like, okay, this is just some water with grass and it's just a normal swamp. But when you kind of, when they cut to certain scenes with it, you can really kind of feel this sense of horror kind of thing. But it's interesting they're able to get something like that from something that I guess on paper looks so kind of basic, especially when you got people that are traveling in the water and they're doing whatever. But I like it so far. I'm obviously going to finish the show. I don't know when that's going to be, but I've finished Lost in Space now, which I'll talk about in a second, but so I'm back to watching Swamp Thing properly. But no, I like it so far. It's pretty good. A couple of different sort of things have been happening in the last 2 episodes roughly, as opposed to the first kind of 4, where it was a bit more focused on Swamp Thing. But in the next couple of episodes, they focus more on what's probably going to be or already is kind of the villain. And I understand you have to, you know, develop other characters and whatnot, so be interesting to see how that kind of finishes, because obviously there's not got a second season, so isn't going to get one. So
I was okay with how it ended. There were threads left dangling that you could have picked up had it gone to a second season, but it's reasonably well self-contained as a one season thing. I thought it did a reasonable job of that, so although it is only one season, I thought it was really good, and it's such a shame they didn't have the guts to keep it going, but it is worth watching. And it's over on Amazon, that one, isn't it? So
yeah. Gonna watch that. It's on Amazon. Lost in Space, the Netflix reboot, I finished it before I went back to Swamp Thing. You know, it's just a good kind of, like I was saying to my friend, it's a good kind of just family friendly survival in space kind of thing. And the show doesn't feel like it sort of needs, you know, any swearing or any particular violence or anything like that. It's just this family who's together. They have to figure out how to survive like on this planet together, and there's of course the robots and whatnot, and there's different changes with that, and this particular woman who's in the show who's not very nice. It's just really kind of well done, and obviously has some cool sort of sci-fi stuff going on, and some cool other little robots as well. I thought it was pretty good. And plus, season 2 comes out very soon, doesn't it, on Christmas Eve?
Season 2's out Christmas Eve. I really enjoyed the first season of that. I thought it was a nicely put together update of something which is a fairly cheesy classic title, but I thought they did a lovely job in the way that they updated it, in the relationship between Will and the robot, which they've lent into quite heavily, and I think Will going forward as well. And I thought that was a really nice idea how they put that together. I just thought it was a really nice family sci-fi done very, very well. And, you know, it's got the production budget there. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do for season 2. The season 2 2 trailer has some really nice little bits in it. There's, as I mentioned before, there's a bit where they're kind of sailing the ship across because they land on an ocean or on an ocean planet or something. I'm looking forward to that.
I've actually avoided the season 2 trailer so far. I haven't actually seen that yet because I've only just finished the first season. I thought it'd be better to avoid the trailer for the next season. But I'll watch the trailer probably. Isn't there 2 trailers or something at the moment?
There's a couple. I think there's one main one and they released one earlier as well, I think.
I'll be able to check those out now. If you're looking for a good sci-fi, family-friendly kind of thing to watch with your family over Christmas, maybe, plus there's going to be another season by that time, I'd recommend Lost in Space. So Call of Duty Modern Warfare Season 1, this game is going more of like a Fortnite kind of route, where Fortnite likes to do different seasons of different things, because Call of Duty never sort of used to be like that at all. In fact, there was a very big thing with the old Call of Duty games called Prestige Mode. And basically, there was 10 different prestiges. Once you reached rank, it changed per game, but let's say like 55 or 70, you would prestige, then you would go to prestige 1, and then you do that over and over and over again until you get to prestige 10, and then you would be at maximum kind of rank. But this, they are basically, I think every season they reset your rank to like 55 or something. They don't strip away any weapons or anything that you've earned or anything like that, but they've introduced like a battle pass kind of thing, and it's basically this like progression type of bar. You unlock different things as this bar goes across, and obviously you do the objectives in the game and whatnot in order to push that bar up. So your rank almost kind of doesn't matter as much anymore, but it's all about going up the battle pass sort of thing. There's free content in there, and there's also paid content, but the paid content is for the actual season pass that you buy, so it's up to you if you want both of those, but there is some free stuff that you can get. They've also added a map called Crash, which is a map from the original Modern Warfare, Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, the 2007 game, called Crash, which I'm very familiar with, got a lot of sort of nostalgia for. That's when I used to play the game quite a lot, and kind of strange recently going back into that map and seeing all the little different just places within that I used to sort of go to, obviously. They're going to be adding 2 other ones. I think one's called Quarry and the other one is called Shipment, and they're going to be adding, I think they're adding 1 a month possibly, just to sort of spread the release out a bit, so we'll see what they're like. Hopefully they don't rotate those maps out, because I'd like them to keep them in, but it's been a good little update so far, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with the rest of that season. So plus I've been playing just a bunch of it lately. The morning show, I watched the pilot of, and when I checked there was 9 episodes out. I'm guessing that's how many, because they didn't they do 3 and then they did one a
yeah
week,
they,
sort of like
they
a
released
Hulu
they released
thing.
3 to start off with. It seems to be their release schedule tends to be 3 to start off with, and then they release them weekly, so they get you enough to get you kind of going and get you into the show, and then and then they're releasing them weekly, which is a nice way of doing it, I think.
I think that's kind of what Hulu does, isn't it, with like Handmaid's Tale and obviously their other
shows. Might very well be.
I think so. Obviously, as you'd said, like a couple of months ago, it's based around the whole like Me Too scandal sort of thing. I like how, because I'm assuming this, is it Mike that Steve Carell is playing? I'm assuming he's not based on a real person.
They've always said not directly, although there are elements of some of the, not that we really know them over here, but some of the morning hosts in the US have got caught up in Me Too scandals, but they have said it isn't directly related to that, because they were sort of writing some of this as the stories were breaking, and it just so happened that some of the morning show people got involved, got kind of not people from the Apple show, but some of the people that are on morning shows in America got caught up in Me Too scandals at the same time that they were making this.
What I do like about it is that they've still got obviously the real world event of the Me Too thing, but they've used a somewhat original character and not kind of used one of the names that were involved in the scandal, and kind of made it kind of more fictional but in a real world kind of thing, because obviously none of these like characters exist or whatever, but it's still based in the real Me Too situation. Really interesting kind of first episode that does focus more on Jennifer Aniston's character, and she's the other co-host partner, isn't she? And her kind of dealing with Mike's like departure and firing and whatnot. Now that they focus quite a lot on her character, I'm very interested to see more of Mike and what they do with it. Like, how does he explain his way out of this? What does he kind of, I guess, do now? You saw some of his like obviously initial reaction with smashing his TV up. Very interested to see where it goes, and interested to also see, because you got Reese Witherspoon's character, who seems a bit more like a side character, but she's obviously getting herself involved with the whole, was it Mine thing that she did on the video?
In the opening episode, she's Bradley Jackson, who is a field reporter, but yeah, she does get more involved with the morning show later on. But it's Mitch, not Mike, by the way. I knew that sounded quite slightly off. But yeah, Steve Carell's character is Mitch. But it's a really interesting show and how they're handling their approach to sort of dramatizing a lot of that meaty stuff, because there is real life stuff in there as well. You know, they talk a lot about it, sort of set as the Harvey Weinstein scandal, which sort of forced all the Me Too stuff out.
Mentions him, doesn't he?
It's set around the same time as that, or slightly after that, because they're covering all those kind of Me Too things, and it's sort of that second wave of Me Too stuff that came out. So they are using some real life stuff. And there is a point where they cover some stuff on the California wildfires and things like that. So they are using some real world events, but obviously all these characters are fictional and not specifically based on anybody. But I'm finding it a really interesting approach to what goes on behind the scenes. How complicit was the network in everything that actually happened, which is a question that comes up. It's just nicely played and from a kind of really interesting angle. And I think Jennifer Aniston's fabulous in it. It's a solid sort of dramatic role, but it's also kind of funny in places as well. Steve Carell is brilliant. Reese Witherspoon is great. I really like Billy Crudup, who was he's Corey, who's the new executive who he's brought into from the entertainment division to run the news division, because as we all know, American news is more entertainment than it is news at this point in some cases. So it's a solid cast and it's a really good show, and it's got various Golden Globe nominations there now. Last week, and I think it's very well deserved. Very, very well deserved. I really like that show. I think they've done a stunning job with it.
They've got I don't know how many people recognize him, but Mark Duplass, he plays he's Chip. With Jennifer Aniston's character.
Yeah, he's the exec producer of the morning show, Chip.
He's got this film series called Creep.
Yes.
And there's two Creep films. I think they're both on Netflix, which must have been where I watched them. I think they're both on Netflix. There's a Creep 3 in development, I assume, with him obviously kind of returning and whatnot. But that's where I kind of recognized him. And interesting to see him play a much calmer person than what he does in Creep. So and also interesting with because obviously, like I said, I watched an episode of Friends yesterday, which was from 2004. So I watched a 2004 and a 2019 Jennifer Aniston.
Yes.
So that was quite interesting. Yeah, but that's what I've been up to.
For me, I've had a bit of an Amazon week this week. Amazon dropped a load of new shows. It's been quite nice because Amazon have sort of dropped all their stuff early December, and Netflix are dropping all their stuff late December. And then BBC have got a load of stuff coming in early January, along with a few, Netflix have got stuff coming out still then. So it's quite a nice spread at the moment.
Yeah.
But Marvelous Mrs. Maisel came back a couple of weeks ago, I think actually it was earlier last week. And I've only just got round to catching up with the first episode of that. It's the same as it always has been. It's brilliantly written. It's just hilariously funny. I love the writing on that show. As I said before, if you're a fan of the Gilmore Girls, it's exactly the same writers, and you can tell. The quippiness of the conversations between the leads is very much in that sort of fast-talking Gilmore Girls style. It just works so well, and the jokes for the stand-up, I think, are fabulously written. Just adore that series, and again, I think that's got Golden Globe nominations and completely deserved. The Expanse dropped this week as well for season 4. One of the best hard sci-fis out there that you can get. The fourth season, I'm 2.5 episodes in, I think, at the moment, because I had to go to bed last night. But 2.5 episodes in, thoroughly enjoying it. I won't go into any details just in case people are running behind, but basically picks up at the end of the third season and carries on that story. Takes them to a very interesting, different place. What I've loved about The Expanse is every single season has kind of twisted the story in a slightly different direction and have them in majorly different settings each time. You know, same, generally the same cast, but they're in very different locations from at the start of the season to the end of the season. So it completely alters what happens with the following season. And that's been the same again this year. Very much looking forward to watching any more of that. I'm aware people may be behind on The Expanse, so I don't want to kind of go into any great detail detail and give anything away with that. And New Amsterdam, the medical drama, which is also on Amazon, returned for the first half of their second season. Great, strong opening episode with a lovely, lovely twist at the end. I kind of figured what the twist was fairly early, but I thought they presented it very, very well. But yes, if you're into medical dramas, that is definitely one I would go and watch, and you can binge through the first 9 episodes of that right now. Gaming wise, I have now finished Fallen Order.
Cool.
Thoroughly enjoyed playing through that. I was getting a bit annoyed because I'm not great with the lightsaber. I was getting a little bit annoyed with getting killed a lot. So I ended up you can go in with the slider halfway through the game and just reduce the settings down. And I actually reduced the settings down because I really only cared about the story. I wasn't really there to bash monsters particularly. So the story's solid though. Really nice addition. And everything is canon at this point, I seem to remember. Basically, anything that comes out in the Star Wars universe at this point is canon. So it means that these characters exist in the wider Star Wars universe, which is quite interesting. So
that's cool.
I'm kind of intrigued to see whether they show up somewhere else later on, because obviously they are modeled on the actual actors. So you could do this perfectly reasonably in live action and have them look exactly the same. So apart from the ones that are obviously got forearms and are aliens, but I mean, you know, in terms of the lead guy, you know, you could...
Cameron Monaghan, Cal.
Yeah. Cameron Monaghan, who best known as playing the not Joker in...
apparently not Joker.
Yes, in Gotham. he's great in this as well. And I mean, although it's a video game, you can sort of say that because most of these video games are performance capture at this point. It's not just voice acting. They are actually acting the roles out, and then just it's getting translated into a video game. So, but I think he's fabulous in this. And it's a really interesting, engaging story. It's kind of a cross between Uncharted and Tomb Raider, I guess.
I would say it's, well, obviously Star Wars meets Uncharted meets a bit of Sekiro sort of thing, because Sekiro's got, you know, there's like meditation spots and that sort of thing. Sekiro has them in their work, basically, exactly the same. I never finished Sekiro, but
it's Tomb Raider's Tomb Raider's very much the same, actually. It's sort of a cross between the Tomb Raider, Uncharted and Star Wars, which is no bad thing as far as I'm concerned. I think they've done a fabulous job with it. Maybe a little shorter than I'd possibly want, but that's just me being greedy. I hope they do more of it. It seems to have been selling pretty well, as far as I can tell. And also, I think they put it on Steam as well. It's the first time that EA have actually put games back on Steam rather than just putting them on their own platform. So PC, it's been good. It is definitely one worth picking up if you're looking for something to pick up for a Star Wars fan this Christmas that hasn't got it already. And Planet Zoo, I've still been playing, who've got an expansion coming out. They've got a winter expansion coming out, which adds things like reindeers and snow foxes and that sort of stuff. So I'm very much looking forward into getting into that and being able to create like Christmas is used. That should be kind of fun. That's all the stuff we've been doing. We have, of course, over on the website still got this running. The Geektown Awards. So the Geektown Awards are still running, the prize list is huge once again. You can win all of this. The Geektown Awards main prize this year includes DVDs of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Avengers Age of Ultron, Thor Ragnarok, Doctor Strange, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Captain America Civil War, and Captain Marvel. We also have Blu-rays of Avengers Endgame, Shazam, and Spider-Man Far From Home. We have books, comic books, and games, including a Transformers notebook, a Star Wars pop culture art book, Justice League graphic novel, Batman graphic novels, Avengers graphic novels, a Matrix jigsaw puzzle, a Rick and Morty jigsaw puzzle, DC Originals character photo booth, and a Starseekers Awakening trading card game. We have figures and ornaments, including Funko Pops of Preacher's Jesse Custer, South Park's Captain Chaos, and Rick and Morty's Scary Terry. We have Funko Bobbleheads of Walking Dead's Daryl Dixon and Mel Dixon, and Star Wars Boba Fett. We also have a talking Anchorman Ron Burgundy bobblehead. We have vinyl figures of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad. We have a plushy Stormtrooper. We have a Game of Thrones Sansa Stark vinyl figure. Jay and Silent Bob vinyl figures. A Highlander collectible Connor McCloud, and a DC Joker bath duck. There's a host of other geeky stuff as well, including a Trainspotting T2 t-shirt, Batman egg cups, Call of Duty socks and baseball cap, the Cobra Kai soundtrack on CD, Big Bang Theory coasters, Star Wars mugs, Harry Potter posters, a Suicide Squad wallet, a Rock Hat cone gaming mouse, and a stack of other geeky bits and pieces. And finally, we have a Now TV smart stick with a selection of testers for the entertainment, cinema and sports packages, an Amazon Fire 7-inch tablet, and a Google Home smart speaker. And if that all wasn't enough, we also have a runner-up prize, which is a geeky mystery box worth £125. All you have to do is head to geektown.co.uk/awards and get voting. So there you go. That's the prize package. It is huge once again. As I said there, go to geektown.co.uk/awards and you can be in with a chance with winning all that stuff. That's all the stuff from us this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
TV and film news this week, we kick off with renewals, cancellations and pickups. Not much in terms of those this week as we are coming up to Christmas, but ITV did announce that Sedition, which was that Jane Austen drama that they did, it seems to have come out that it's been cancelled. But when I actually looked on the listing, I think they only announced it as a mini series in the first place. So there were some things around saying it had been cancelled. I think what had happened was the guy that wrote it said, oh, well, if it goes down well, you know, maybe we could do another one, and basically it hasn't made enough money for them, so they're not bringing it back. But I think it was only really planned initially as a miniseries anyway, so cancelled-ish, I guess. Yes, so they're not bringing it back is what they're saying. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, however, is coming back, not unsurprisingly, after it got, I think, 2 or 3 Golden Globe nominations this week. And the new season has come out and has apparently been one of the most watched things on Amazon. Yes, season 3 is now out. Season 4, it has been renewed for. So Marvelous Mrs. Maisel will be back for a full season. And again, this was another one. Disenchantment, Netflix announced that part 3 is coming in 2020. Now, part 3 technically is season 2 because part 1 and 2 were season 1. They've done this with a few shows and it gets very confusing. But they initially ordered, I think, 40 episodes split over 2 seasons. So part 1 and 2 were season 1. Part 3 is season 2, part 1, I guess. So they're saying, oh, it's been renewed for a 3rd season. It actually hadn't. It would already ordered for 2 seasons anyway. They're just announcing that the 3rd part, which is first part of the 2nd season, is coming in 2020. So, but yay, more enchantment for people that like the show.
I forgot the 2nd part actually came out, to be honest, just because it kind of got buried.
Yeah, there was a lot of other stuff. I think when they announced it came out, there was quite a lot of other stuff that was released. So yes, so there's that as well. Moving on to other news, over on Showtime, they've announced an interesting sounding show called The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. It's an intriguing looking setup. It's actually based on Michael Chabon's Pulitzer Prize winning novel. It's comic book adjacent rather than being a comic book show, because it is about the story of 2 Jewish cousins, Czech artist Joe Cavalier and Brooklyn-born writer Sammy Clay, who become important figures in the growing comic book industry before, during and after the Second World War, creating a superhero called the Escapist. So it's sort of a fictionalized version of the birth of that kind of golden age of comics, which is interesting, because I mean, there are a lot of stories out there about things like, you know, Bob Crane creating Batman and the creation of Superman, and how people got screwed over out of rights of things, and Bill Finger for years wasn't included on the credits of Batman, and I think he was the artist and was integral to bringing that character to life, and they never actually put him on any of the credits until fairly recently. So there are a lot of real life stories out there that are quite interesting, but this is a sort of fictionalized version of that, I guess, so they can play with the idea a bit more. So I'd rather like the sound of this. I think it could be quite interesting, because it's sort of comic book related but not directly comic book stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be interesting. We don't know. See who gets obviously cast for it and whatnot, and see, you don't really know visually how good it's going to be until we see a trailer, which I'm guessing is going to be a bit of time, but just another one we'll have to wait and see on. So I don't often hear about like Showtime that much. I remember on a recent, I think, streaming service discussion thing I did, I went through all the streaming services and sort of got to Showtime and was like, oh, I don't really hear about that quite so much anymore, but there's still some stuff on there, I suppose.
It's one of those things that certainly in the UK, because they have a deal with Sky Atlantic, they have a carriage deal like the HBO carriage deal with Sky Atlantic, the shows over here get a little bit mashed together. So you might think that it's a HBO show and it actually isn't. It's a Showtime series. Like Billions is actually a Showtime series and that airs on there. Ray Donovan is a Showtime series. And
yeah, you know, House of Lies is as well.
House of Lies, I've mentioned a few times. At least Homeland, I think, is a Showtime series, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But it predated the deal with Sky Atlantic, which is why it airs on Channel 4. So, yeah, there are a few kind of oddities about that, but there are some great things on Showtime. It's one of those things that, because we don't know it as a separate entity over here, they kind of get buried as part of Sky Atlantic. And everybody knows about the HBO deal, but not many people realize they have that same deal with Showtime as well. I expect this to be a decent, high quality drama. It's based on a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, so you know the source material is going to be good. It's just going to depend on what the casting's like and when it comes out. But yes, it's Alex Kurtzman and Akiva Goldsman are the two executive producers of the project, and they're the people behind the Star Trek franchise as well. I think that's kind of interesting. You know, he's got a fairly good geek cred in terms of the people behind it, so it should be one to watch out for that. Earlier this week, Marvel announced that Marvel TV was going to shut down with all the current series being folded into Marvel Studios. I mean, this has been coming for a fairly long time.
Yeah.
You know, we'd lost like Daredevil, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, Punisher, all those Netflix shows. They announced that the Runaways upcoming third season will be its last. They cancelled Cloak and Dagger after two seasons. They dropped that Ghost Rider spin-off. Tiger and Dazzler, which is one of the animated series that they were going to do, that's also stalled. So there was a lot of things that had kind of been installed, and I know people are going, oh, this is all Disney Plus's fault. It's nothing to do with Disney Plus. This is mainly to do with the fact that Kevin Feige, who's the man behind the MCU in the Marvel Universe, his job role has slightly changed and he's now Chief Creative Officer of everything Marvel. Jeff Loeb, who was the creative head of Marvel TV, had decided that he was going to leave. It's really a combination of those two things pushed Marvel into a position of saying, well, actually, we may as well just get rid of the TV division entirely and fold everything into Marvel Studios. I think it makes sense. And a lot of the TV that they're doing now is related to the MCU, and it gives them further control over TV shows moving forward as well. So the shows which have survived the shutdown are the final seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. That will still happen. The live action Hellstrom series on Hulu, that is still happening. And the four remaining animated series, which is Marvel's MODOK, Hitmonkey, Howard the Duck, and The Offenders, those are all still going forward as far as you're aware at the moment as well. There is still a few kind of leftovers, and then obviously on the Marvel Studios side there are all the Falcon, Winter Soldier, Loki and WandaVision and all that stuff which is on the Disney Plus channel. Those are obviously all coming because they were under Marvel Studios anyway, so it's not like they're not going to keep on making Marvel things. I think talked before about whether that we could see some of the Defenders shows reappear in maybe on Hulu in a few years, because there's that exclusion deal from them airing anything from the Netflix show. So
yeah, there's the 2 year thing, isn't it?
Yeah, there's like a 2 year break. But so it's possible that you may see some of them pop back up on.
I don't quite know why Marvel wouldn't bring those back.
Yeah.
Because you could easily put those on, I don't know, Hulu or FX or...
Yeah, Hulu seems the most likely place for them, I would think.
Yeah, because they own several different channels at this point. I mean, Disney owns a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of different... Because obviously those shows wouldn't obviously be suitable for Disney Plus, but Hulu's a very likely avenue for them.
That's exactly the reason why Hellstrom is on there, because it's a more...
Howard the Duck, I think. That's a Hulu show, isn't it?
Howard the Duck and The Offenders and those animated series, because they're more adult in content and it allows them to get away with more stuff, because the Disney Plus channel is what they call PG-13. They still put The Mandalorian on there, but there's nothing like blood and guts. There's nothing overly violent in that. So Hulu would seem like the obvious place to put stuff. So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to see them revise some of those.
But I mean, the Defenders aren't small kind of characters. I mean, people like Daredevil and that aren't particularly small, so I think that they'll still do something with them. I do hope some of the original cast managers come back, like Charlie Cox as, yeah. You know, obviously Daredevil, hopefully they get him, because those the people that they cast, obviously, is it Kristen Ritter?
Kristen Ritter,
John Bernthal was Punisher and that. They're really kind of perfect in those roles, so hopefully they don't have to recast because of scheduling and whatnot. So
notice how you skipped over Iron Fist there.
Right, I was just the ones that came off the top of my head.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I would love to see Jessica Jones and Daredevil back, particularly, and Punisher. I mean, you know, those are the three ones that really stand out, I think.
I think for Iron Fist specifically, I think it really would help if you did a Heroes for Hire and put him with Luke Cage.
Yeah.
I think that would help both of those characters a lot, because I think, I mean, a lot of people like Luke Cage, and if you like it, that's good with you and whatnot, but I really think pairing those two together would make both of the stories kind of better. So, yeah, plus there's an actual comic run of that, isn't there?
Yeah,
so
exactly. I very much agree with you on that. I think if you were going to do another series, merging those two characters would make far more sense.
I think those are the two weakest shows out of that lot. So.
Yeah. It would be nice to see some of those back, and maybe it will happen down the road, but we'll see. Overall, I think Kevin Feige being in charge of everything, it also means that you could, if you did bring those characters back, they would be part of the wider MCU at that point. More directly than they have been, you know, because the problem with Marvel TV and Marvel Studios was, whilst there was some crossover, like with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. very early on, they diverged quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it would be better if they're all under one management and they're all under one roof, and then you could more effectively do crossovers. So we'll see. But overall, I think it's probably a good thing from a fan point of view. I think it's going to be better moving forward. And the last news story we have, HBO Max are developing a series based on the National Lampoon Vacation franchise. Do you know the National Lampoon franchise at all? I don't know if you've seen any of these movies. I mean, they're classic John Hughes films, and they've been around for years and years and years. They were Chevy Chase movies, and Chevy Chase sort of was the lead in it, and it was,
I recognize that name.
Wasn't he in Community, or was he in Parts and Rec? He was in one of them.
Oh yeah, he was in Community. Yeah,
it was Community.
Yeah. I recognize his name. Yeah, from the credits, his name just kind of popped into my head. So
I mean, probably arguably a bigger 80s film star than, you know, but that's probably where you know from. The movie franchise involved around various different family vacations for the Griswold family, and they usually went horribly wrong and had non-stop disasters, embarrassing things happen, and they had like a European vacation and a Christmas vacation, and so there was various versions of it. They're now talking about doing a TV spin-off, which is sort of very loosely a continuation of that film franchise. It's Johnny Galecki who is the person behind it, who that name you will know from Big Bang Theory. He played Leonard in Big Bang Theory. So it's him and Tim Holbert, who was one of the Community writers, and he also wrote The Middle and Spin City. That he's writing the script and exec producing along with Galecki. Interesting people behind it. There's no casting news at the moment. There's no news on whether any of the original cast will return, because obviously, I mean, these have been going since the 80s, these movies. They have done movies that followed some of the children before. I mean, Galecki himself actually played Rusty Griswold, who is one of the kids in the 1989 Christmas Vacation movie. So he has a connection to the franchise anyway. But they've done versions with other people playing like the grown-up versions of the kids as they've gone through. So it may be that they follow one of the children and you have guest spots from people like Chevy Chase in it, but don't know at all at the moment. All we know is it's based around the sort of vague idea of following the Griswold family. Rather than vacations, it will be them at home in Chicago and just daily life in the suburbs. So it's sounding very sort of tagged on sitcom-y with lots of mishaps and that sort of thing. But it's a brand name, so that's what they're using. I don't know. Interesting. It's coming to HBO Max. As we've said before, the HBO Max shows currently don't have broadcasters over here because they weren't part of the Sky HBO deal, stupidly. So they could end up anywhere. We'll have to wait and see what happens with those. But
hopefully that will get sorted sooner rather than later. But
I suspect they will be sold on a show-by-show basis, I don't think you're going to end up with them all ending up at one place. Not unless Sky go back and decide to do another deal. I don't think you're going to end up with all the HBO Max shows in one place. But we'll have to wait and see. But it's one to look out for anyway. Mm-hmm. That's all the news for this week. Next, we have an interview. The interview this week is with the cinematographer for a show both me and Matt absolutely love, Watchmen, and it is Greg Middleton, who is one of the... There's actually quite a few cinematographers on Watchmen, as you might expect for a series like that. He is one of the main guys. He's responsible for four of the episodes, the second episode, the fourth, the sixth, and the eighth, because they sort of alternate. But as he explains in the interview, there are many other cinematographers involved in various parts of the project as well. It's a fabulous, fabulous series. One of the episodes that he was involved with was This Extraordinary Being, which I won't give anything away, but the entire episode was shot in black and white. Obviously, there are spoilers in this interview for some of the episodes. So if you haven't watched Watchmen and you don't want to be spoiled by anything, don't go and listen to this. Wait until you've watched the show. Really, you should be watching the show anyway because it's brilliant, but there are spoilers in here to be warned. He's worked on other projects as well. He worked extensively on Game of Thrones. He worked on The Killing, Fringe, Smallville. He also worked on James Gunn's Slither movie, which is the movie James Gunn did before he became incredibly famous in the MCU. He was really interesting to talk to. We get into a lot of stuff about the cinematography of the show and also talk a little bit about the cinematography on Game of Thrones as well. So here's the interview with Greg Middleton. We will see you afterwards with lots of highlights for the next few weeks on TV. It's lovely to have you on to chat. I'm such a huge fan of Watchmen.
So oh, great.
It's been phenomenal. As somebody who was a huge fan of the books, I think Damian Lindelof's done an incredible job doing what he said, which was remixing things.
I think there's a lot of people that were dubious when he preemptively the world that he was going to attempt this, because he can be a divisive figure as far as writing goes. But I must say, in some ways, I mean, if you look back at his other work, you can see the influence that this book has had on him and the rest of his work earlier. And I think it's become like the perfect marriage of both his loves and his talents. And with this material, it's created something really unique. And, you know, it's one of these like lightning of all things where I think it's at this time in this way with him has created something, you know, that's really going to be unique and it's going to last a long time, which is really exciting.
Yeah, it was just a really interesting approach to it of doing a sort of sequel to the book, but without treading on anything that's already in it. And then also remixing elements out of the book into something entirely new. There are kind of touch points that you can spot if you know the novel that come up again, but he has done them in very different ways. It's just an incredibly clever bit of writing. By the time this goes out, the finale will have gone out. So very much looking forward to, you know, hoping he manages to land it and everything ties up.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I can't speak about the finale, obviously, because there are no spoilers there. And I only shot a very small portion of it. So I've read it, obviously, but I'm not going to comment on
that
portion. But what I found was so interesting was about what you're just discussing about the remixing of it all is, you know, when we were discussing the scripts at one point in prep and where things were going to go, because we didn't have all the scripts in advance, unlike, you know, something like Thrones where they map the thing out completely. Damon just does like to sort of adjust on the fly. And, you know, as he's completing the sort of puzzle of the clock that he's making, like it's sort of a constant state of adjustment as he's writing the season. So we were discussing the various scenes coming up, and the scene in 8 between Ozymandias and Dr. Manhattan is very much the kind of conversation you can easily have imagined happening at some point after the novel, the graphic novel. It's completely like that, which is the jumping off point, which of a lot of the story comes from this conversation. Just like the same way that Dr. Manhattan eventually might get bored making life, as he said, he's going to go make life somewhere else because he is still a human being, even though he can't relate to human beings and want to try and fall in love again. And so those two jumping off points were completely logical and made a lot of sense. If you're a big fan of the graphic novel, that would be where this entire story was generated from, right? Which you see in episode 8, oh, that's where it all did start. I was so impressed with that. was like, oh, that's a conversation I want to see. I can't wait to. I was lucky enough to get to shoot that conversation and film that. But it was it's an interesting and so completely perfect spot on position that those characters would be in, you know, 10 or 15 years after the graphic novel.
Yeah, it works so well and has an amazing punny title. That episode as well. God walks into a bar, which is just brilliant.
Angela just picked that name because, well, we met in a bar, so we'll call ourselves a bar.
Yeah, you know, it's just great.
They obviously picked their name, so it's not like...
Yeah, it's brilliant. You are our co-cinematographer on this.
In actuality, there's totally every 5 different cinematographers' hands on the series. So Andrei Parekh shot the pilot, which we did reshoot a chunk of once we started going, and I shot episodes 2, 4, 6, and 8. Javier Grobet shot episodes 3, 5, and 7. And Alex Disanoff shot episode 9, which is on next week. And also he did some of the Jeremy Irons work around the catapult, which was shot in Atlanta, where his show is based.
Right.
And then all the stuff in the castle in Jeremy Irons' manor at the castle and around the grounds of the castle, close to the castle, was all shot in Wales. That was shot way early in pre-production. And that was shot by Chris Seeger, who's a British cameraman.
Right. Yes.
So it's all shot early. Like, they wrote all those scenes before the rest of the scripts were ready. And they were shooting that while we were in pre-production. So the whole, you know, us developing the look of the show and starting when I began pre-production for episode 2, which we just started to discuss the various concepts. And at the same time, I was talking to Chris on Skype about lens choices, because we're like, well, here's what we're talking about this week is where we might be going with this. But he's like, well, I'm shooting next week, so I got to pick. So it's like, we haven't quite decided where we're going to go yet, but they're going to shoot all theirs. And his world does have its own sort of language anyways, which was the whole point. It was supposed to be, you know, the blonde man scenes are like, you know, a Merchant Ivory production. It'll be sort of, you're suddenly in another period film. You don't understand where you are, and which worked out quite well. So it actually worked out well. So in the end, it was me and Javier alternating on the season when I began up until the end there.
Right. Yeah. That's a lot of people to juggle, to try and make sure that you're shooting in exactly the same way. So they kind of all match, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And it's something that, I had quite a bit of experience on Game of Thrones for 3 seasons. And when I joined, I was like the 15th cinematographer to join that series, right? I mean, there's been, because they would pair you up with a director on that show. So there'd be often 5 cinematographers per season.
Right.
You know, so if you knew them. Yeah. So that's the way, which is a very different way. Most TV series, when I worked on The Killing, for example, where I met Nicole Cassell, the director that I worked with on Watchmen on episodes 2 and 8, that series, I shot every episode. So I was, you know, prepping on the weekends with a new director. And then you have a real, obviously a big hand in the story continuity. On Game of Thrones, you're paired with the director. It works unlike any other show, where they keep you with your director and they basically block shoot and schedule the entire season. So that way, if they're going to go to a city in Spain, for example, everything in that city will be shot, you know, in the same 2 weeks for the entire season. So in which case, there may be scenes from 4 episodes in there, 2 or 3 days each, and they'll be one after the other. So I will go in with my director and our first AD and I'll shoot for 3 days and then I will leave. The crew will stay there. The next director DP will go in and shoot their scene for 3 or 4 days. And I'll go back to Belfast and prep. And so your days aren't consecutive and you end up with this very, very stretched out schedule where you're both prepping and shooting, you know, sort of continuously sprinkled throughout 3 or 4 months, which is very different.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it allows for a lot of cinematographers to overlap, because we're obviously sharing sets. We're also telling a 10-hour story in a season of Game of Thrones. So we do talk a lot about, well, I'm going to do this in this scene and you've got this scene coming up in the same set. You know, we want to not do the same thing. We want to make sure we leave our, just even technically, I want to leave the set in good shape for my compatriot coming after me. Or share ideas about how to accomplish certain looks, and while still, you know, shooting our own story and shooting how we think is best for our own 2 episodes. So it's, you know, there's more. I've been lucky to have opportunities to overlap with other cinematographers before. So in this case, I kind of knew that was the case. And as I started episode 2 in prep, you know, we wanted to make some adjustments and some refinements of like developed, like what should the look of the show be? Because I had a strong working relationship with Nicole and she really empowered me. And so did Damon, those guys, like, look, here's what we like about the pilot. Here's what we're uncertain of. Here's what we're going to be redoing anyways, because now we've recast a couple of characters and we built a couple of big sets that did not exist during the pilot. Like the police station set was not, you know, did not exist. So a lot of stuff was going to get redone. There was a chance also then, whatever we're going to be adjusting, to put that stuff, those styles, into the pilot as well. And the big thing was we tackled it kind of like a film. Like, well, here we have a big piece of reference, like the, as Damon called, the Old Testament, which is the graphic novel. And we have a bunch of things we like from the pilot that worked, that we think is good ideas, and other things we're not too sure about. let's develop and how we go from there. So it became like a fact-finding mission of, you know, pulling what those resources were that we liked, all the, you know, still images from films and parts of the show that we liked a lot. And a lot of concepts from the graphic novel that could translate over visually, because not all of them will or will make sense, and piece them together and start to build a little Bible of like, okay, let's some suggestions of do's and don'ts and things to avoid and things to strive for, and build it out like that. And then we sort of applied all that to our pilot reshoots and episode two and sort of built from there. And then after Javier joined us a few weeks after I've been prepping, he was like, okay, great, I get this idea. And then he would, you know, take it further and the crew would get used to working that way. And so you sort of, it's a, it becomes a team thing where we sort of all sort of approach it together.
Yeah.
Because the great thing about that is working with real brilliant people. I mean, Javier is a brilliant cinematographer. He lights beautifully. It's nice to have someone else with you to be able to discuss these concepts with and do tests and things like that. You know, it's you were often kind of, you know, alone on our island as a cinematographer. You're kind of by yourself with your director and your film, which is also kind of great. But in something as moving as quickly as this project, and especially when you get the script and you realize, oh, this script has got, like, you know, science fiction new places. It's got giant vivariums. It's got period pieces. It's got the war It's got, like, and you realize I have so many of these different things to juggle. It's a bit much to do in the amount of time. I mean, prepping this project was more like prepping a really, really large, complex movie. And I only had 5 or 6 weeks to prep a thing when we started episode two. And we were trying to look down the line of the various things we have to do. In episode two, I've got the German war office. I've got the ladies with the typewriters, and you've got all this at the beginning. And then suddenly you're in the bakery at night, and we want to have a film noir conversation. And we're going to bring in ideas like split diopters to put like the pill bottle big in the foreground and to link him to the pills and things like, there's a lot of sort of thinking about these things in advance. And that was super exciting to do. So the short answer is you sort of start when you're I'm the only person there. I'm doing my best to sort of start the process off and come up with a few concepts, and then Javier will add to them, and then we'll become a conversation after time we shoot a scene and we like and don't like, and then halfway through that we'll look at some stuff together once the cuts start coming in and adjust from there and keep developing as we go.
Yeah. And you mentioned the book there as being used as reference on set. Were you a fan of the book beforehand, or was it something you ended up binging through?
I wasn't a fan like when it first came out. It was more, it was around the time that the film 2009 came out. I was like, oh, I should look at this thing, because there was a couple I liked a little bit of comics when I was young, but I never got into this one. And then when I reading this one, I was really blown away by just the structure of it. And it's a really complex piece of writing.
Yeah.
It's also very of the 80s. People forget the kind of amount of content. I mean, there's, you know, there's the idea of a woman falling out with a rapist and stuff is maybe a bit of a trope today. Which I don't think that would fly in a script these days. But it's also, you know, it's as a piece of writing, as a commentary of the time of the 80s and where comics were, you know, it's a pretty pointed critique, right? And he was deliberately trying to make a piece of work that was like, if these people were real people, what would they really be like? Yeah, a lot of them would be very dysfunctional, and they would be, you know, they're all filled with massive contradictions. I mean, Rorschach, people remember him fondly, but the guy is pretty psychotic. And he says no compromise. He compromises all the time, except the things that he doesn't want to compromise on. And there's these people filled with contradictions are really interesting. And the structure of that story, especially the one where Dr. Manhattan experiences time, which is what, you know, Damon echoed so beautifully in episode 8. Mm. It's a really brilliantly written thing as he realized his problem with connection with people because he is experiencing time in this nonlinear fashion.
Yes.
That's a really clever, a difficult concept to bring across in any way. And it came across really well in this format of a graphic novel. It was kind of a brilliant way to show that. So I was a fan of it from that perspective. And then because it was Damon's big reference, is like it is the history of our show. It's the real history of our world and show that he's creating, both for all the details and then also for all the little Easter eggs they want to put in visually, silhouettes of people on the wall, various visual details. Yeah. We went into Karnak at the end. Nick Hood, it was a brilliant on-set dresser, is a huge fan of the comic. He would always be looking for the little details he can make sure he gets in the frame. And part of our visual development, the thing we were talking about earlier, was to try and compose carefully and to compose with objects and people in ways to reinforce or subvert what's going on in the scene and the point of view, and just not to be haphazard, to use the frame and try and pepper it with information and using split diopter stuff like that. And so he'd be looking for opportunities like that all the time. And so when we're doing, even like coming into Karnak in 8, when Dr. Manhattan comes in and he walks down the long hall, like we're discussing how to do that. It's like, well, it'd be great if he had to walk for a bit, because then he'll walk past all this stuff and we'll get to see, you know, the latitude of things. And also there's Easter eggs for all the stuff from, you know, Karnak and the graphic novel to put in there, including like there's a sort of old, like kind of Spartan Roman helmet you know, on the ground we kind of go by as he's walking up to Manhattan, and that's big in the foreground and one of the comic pieces, right? So then he'll have the graphic novel out, he'll have it all on his iPad, try to put the right things in the right place so he can echo that for people that are really big fans, and then, you know, it grounds it in the history of the world too. So
yeah, absolutely, it was great. I was so happy. I was like, that's Karnak when it came on screen.
Yeah,
the one episode we really need to talk about, I think, is This Extraordinary Being, which was a phenomenal bit of TV. I do love that episode. Was it always going to be shot in black and white, that episode, or was that a decision that was made later on?
It was made in prep. We had a little bit of a break after Christmas. We took a brief hiatus because they were a bit behind in sort of post, and they wanted some more time to, again, sort of adjust from a script and story and, you know, everything standpoint. So we had a little bit of a longer break, which allowed us a bit more time to ponder this episode, because both me and Christian, the production designer, we were like in desperate fear of this episode, because if you, on paper, you realize, oh, I know how much of it's going to be in period in New York.
Yeah.
And we don't have an unlimited budget. You know, we had enough money to sort of, but it was very tricky. And so where do you do period New York in Atlanta? It's like, oh, God, Super Bowl's coming up. Can't be anywhere in the city. And there's no streets that are dressed appropriately. So we went to Macon, Georgia, which is south of it. And just before the Christmas break, Christian and I had gone to Steven, who was in the middle of just doing pickups for episode 3. And he was hopeful of possibly shooting in actual New York, possibly, if we could swing it. But Christian and I knew that was probably not going to happen. And he was like, look, we just want to go down to Macon, and we're going to go come up with a couple of plans for what streets we can use and what, you know, try and put together a map of what's shootable and how we could fit into our things. I knew we're going to be into long continuous takes, which means you can't use the usual tricks of just like hide, you know, shooting the same wall 4 times, right? To sort of give yourself more period background. If the camera's wandering around with a wide lens, you're going to see a lot. So you have to very carefully pick where you're going to shoot to get the most out of it and not shoot yourself in the foot. So we went down before Christmas, Christian and I, to pick some stuff, made a couple of proposals. And then we had a little bit longer time over the holiday break to consider those, because I knew this was episode was going to be one, is going to be very special just because of the content of it. And also it was going to be an incredible challenge to pull off in the way that we were sort of tasked to do it initially, because the concept of sort of more of a flowing camera was, you know, definitely in the intent and the script, but the idea of this journey of the taking the pills would be like a bit of a first person combination of Birdman and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is another great reference, right? Because at that point his mind's coming apart in that film, and so you can't quite tell what's real, and like the doorways in the middle of the street and things like that, or the script. It's like, yeah, obviously you don't quite know where, you know, which reality you're in, and realities are overlapping, and that, you know, took a lot of figuring out. So for me, that it was about getting the execution right was, you know, so key to keeping the journey of the episode, once it gets going, as compelling as possible. And in that regard, you know, I sort of pitched to production and said, look, in the end, because of the type of these shots, and I was very lucky that our Joe Iberti, one of our main production producers, he had worked on other shows that had done sort of single take scenes before. And so he knew what was involved. He was like, it's hard to describe just the level of preparation you have to have for some of those things. You can't just make them up on the day because there's so much choreography involved.
Yeah.
So I pitched like, look, we really do have to go down to make into our street scenes and bring 2 stand-ins and, you know, I have the scripts and we'll do them all with my viewfinder on my phone. And we need to cut them together and make sure our transitions work and give ourselves a few options so we can look at them. And then we can play the episode scenes together and see if they really work. Cause then I have to also budget this too. I can't just, you know, propose shots that were totally impossible because you know, we have to fit into the budget of how much street can we light, you know, how many cars can we have, all that type of thing. And so the process of prepping the episode was basically trying to shoot the whole episode twice, doing the entire thing, you know, on the viewfinder with our stand-ins, Joel and London, both being off book and, you know, doing all the scenes and then discovering, okay, what's the way? What part of the scene, like, what can we not see? And what do we not mind seeing? Like, if the camera's moving around somebody, when can they be off camera? When, what line can you miss part of? And the scene in the bar, for example, which is like the second scene after he gets his badge pinned on him on the stage.
Right.
That's a 4.5 minute scene almost initially. And there's a couple of cuts. I'm cutting it now. There's a couple of flash cuts to the pilot, which weren't in the original shoot. And that whole thing we did is one continuous shot, which starts at the bar, goes around the table twice. You know, we do a handoff to Regina and back. And then in the background, the KKK member with the woman shows up and gets shot. That's all. They have to enter and, you know, off camera and do all that. And then the piano has to roll in behind us so we can go off that and go to the piano and also go into the piano away, which is exactly the way we'll come off the piano on the street so we can do the seamless transition. And that's all choreographed and what they're acting, with background. I mean, that took us almost all day to do that, but it took us also 3.5 hours in the location to pick the location and see where the table would go. Is there enough room for the camera? Will this sort of choreography generally work? We shot it a few times with London and Joel to figure out the timing of like what type of move, when would we do the switch? And maybe I think we moved the switch in the scene once briefly, or where we were going to be for it. And that takes a lot of time and consideration. And we did that for all of those scenes and worked them all out. Like the whole opening in with the getting the badge on him, we had to be able to see June in the front row, back to him, get the timing right. So he's just being passed over by the commander of the local precinct, and then have Sam Battle then arrive and pin the badge on him. I mean, just even deciding where he should sit, where we would be, how many rows he can see, you know, where the crane will go, like doing all that. We had to do all that in advance for everything. So the preparation process was really involved, but it did give us the proof of concept, and then cut them together. And then Steven could show that to Damon and say, look, this is going to work. We can do it this way. I think we're going to make it all work somehow. And we'll just keep going through each scene and figure out how to do mostly this way. And if the scenes are strong enough and then the acting can keep up with it, and our cast were extraordinary. Like they could do these longer takes and be so spot on. Jovan was incredible, and the lady who played June is also amazing, that they really worked. And so you could start to feel, okay, this is going to work now. Now it's like, okay, now we have to get into these really difficult scenes, like the one with the projector on the wall that goes into the movie, which I was determined to do live. So we did a video projector standing in for film projector, but all that's in camera. So, which was because we didn't want to do it as a visual effect. It would feel a cheat, you know, it should feel like it's real. It should feel like the room dims and somebody's projectors on the wall. And then you can tell if it's kind of been faked, you wouldn't see the light play on the actors the same way. But that took, again, incredible choreography with a small crane and them all getting the lines right and, like, you know, holding up the newspaper so you can see the headline. And anyway, I'm just rambling now, but it was a very long pre-production process to sort of proof the concept. And then we could eventually just tackle one at a time. Okay, now how do we do this one? Like, how do we come off the screen and go into the mirror and reveal that he's in, you know, the white, you know, makeup around his eyes?
Yeah.
And then we have to go into the mirror and reveal it's Regina. Then we have to go from that into the noose knot, and then from that onto a rooftop. And then we have, like, it just, you just, you know, you tackle each one separately and figure out, well, what's the way to do it, and then just build accordingly.
Yeah. I mean, when you're shooting something like that, are you visualizing it in black and white, or is that sort of something you're changing over later on? Because there are little color elements in that as well. So,
yeah. And that, the little colored things are something I pitched strongly for, especially with the red content being so aligned with Cyclops. Like, I wanted the red light of the little recording booth blinking to be red. His folder for Cyclops is red. Mesmerism book would be red. Because I thought that'd be a nice way to just also, like, from a story standpoint, to just hammer home the connection to these things for people, because it is a lot of information being thrown at them.
Yeah.
The basic process for shooting any show or film, the basic concept is, you know, in the old days with film, you know, you'd make a work print and you'd watch your dailies the next day, right? And then, so on set, it would be, you know, I'd be judging the photography by my eye and my, you know, light meters and everything else, and then we would watch our dailies the next day. But now with, you know, digital cameras we've had for a few years now, we have monitors that people can watch, and the monitors are very good, and the monitors are, you know, large, and it's not really fair to have a director or anyone else in the film look at a monitor and say, don't worry, it's not gonna look anything like that later, and have them stare at it all day and have them stare at it in post, because what will happen is they will fall in love with whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's just how the human brain works. We just get used to something. And if you can tell them, you know what, it's going to be all pink later, don't look at the blue image. It doesn't make any sense to them.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't. And so the onus becomes then, you know, my goal in, you know, and when I'm lighting something and photographing something, is I want to create the ability to have something on set that's very close to what the final image is going to be, or what I anticipated it's going to be. Part of that is not doing color grading on set, but sometimes building of what's called a viewing LUT. A LUT is like a lookup table, which is basically a contrast curve you would put on the log signal or the flatter signal that the cameras record to give you the contrast you want. And it's sort of like, in some ways, it's like kind of picking a film stock. It's not It's not changing the signal being recorded, but it's changing the sort of what it's turning that very flat looking negative image, if you want to call it that way, on the what's being recorded, into something that has contrast and balance and saturation and all the things you would associate with the final image.
Right.
And so you can can tweak that to some degree on set with a little bit of color tweaking, but I don't believe in doing, you know, extensive post-production while shooting. My attention needs to be on the camera and, you know, the actors and my director and,
sure,
and the lighting. And so I like to build sort of a viewing light that would give me an approximation of what I want. And we did that for the overall Watchmen show. And we did that on Game of Thrones as well. After I joined, we made a couple of ones that worked really well. And so for this one, it's like once we got into, oh, it's going to be black and white, and we were struggling to figure out where we could land the episode in the palettes we'd already established. We already had flashback things. We wanted to be different than that, but not so different. You know, it was like we're kind of running out of room of where to go. And Damon sensed the same thing. And he was like, yeah, what if we just do it totally black and white? At which point, me and Christian, because at this point we're middle of pre-production and they're already building and painting things. And the one thing about black and white is we rely on color separation a lot sometimes in both set design and costume design.
Sure.
However, if you put a grayscale version of that, just take the saturation all the way down on your TV or your monitor, you'll suddenly see that like two things that can be radically different colors can be exactly the same in black and white.
Of course, yeah.
So you have a very tricky situation sometimes where like a pale green and a pale gray or a pale blue and suddenly everything is the same tone and you're like, uh-oh. And also I have to protect the fact that like, well, what if they decide they don't like it black and white? I can't also assume that it's going to stay this way for sure.
Right.
Because it's television and things can change and, you know, ideas can change later. So I can't make it so it's a disaster if they ever put a color back into it.
Yeah.
So it was a tricky balancing act to find it. But I basically then went back to the same process where Christian and I quickly looked at everything we'd painted and did a quick test in black and white to make sure we didn't have any egregious errors of things being too much the same shade. And we managed to, you know, fix June's apartment a little bit and we made a few adjustments to the brightness of walls. And then I built a black and white viewing LUT, as much like a deep, old, slower black and white film stock as I could.
Right.
I did a bunch of tests with the stuff on set and color charts, things like that I would normally do. I mean, from a sort of, it's a bit technical, but like one thing I'll do when I'm doing setting up an initial camera test for this type of work is I'll, you know, we use a face. There'll be like a color chart, which is a bunch of chip colors on it, a grayscale. And then I'll put other things in the shot as well, like a black reference, something that's totally black, like a black tube that has no light in it. Something very white, something that's peaked out that will blow out. And various things in the background, like sort of highlights or lights in the lens. All the things you might encounter in the environment you're going to be in the world in. So we would take like a piece of wall, which has a eggshell or semi-gloss kind of like old paint, you know, tobaccoed texture to it. And we all use that in the background. Or when we're doing initial Watchmen tests, you know, a piece of concrete for the police station, things like that.
Right.
And then you could sort of start making those adjustments like, okay, well, here's what a black and white film would look like. Here's like a emulation of a, you know, like a Fuji film stock or a film stock with more contrast. And you start playing around with what that will be. And then you've got a good sampling of things in front of you. You're not just making those decisions based on a single item, like not only on the skin tone, you know, you're going to have a lot of things in this together. So I basically did a microcosm of that process again with black and white and came up with something that I was, you know, happy with Todd Bachner, our final colorist. And so I flew to LA from Atlanta to sit with him and work on both the looks of the show and also this black and white thing. And we came up with something that was pretty great. I think it was pretty intense blacks, which I wanted. Like, you know, when your negative would be like, you know, what you're exposing and then your print is the thing you're looking at later.
Yeah.
You know, a common thing would be to sometimes overexpose your negative slightly just to maintain enough detail in the darker areas. That way,
sure,
you have flexibility as you're grading later. And, you know, digital images are similar. Once you get to the point where the reason that log images look very gray is because once there's no information, no luminance information, you can't really change the color of something because there needs to be kind of gray in it for the adjustment to take hold and move it. So what you run into trouble if you have very, very dark images that have no information. If you try and keep changing the color, what happens is the black goes one way and the rest of the image goes something else because there's no information in there anymore. So you get a very strange effect. And knowing this was going to be a sort of a black and white film noir with a lot of heavy contrast, making a LUT that way is a way for me to also protect the amount of information I have in the blacks to make sure I have enough room to really, you know, when I'm grading, if I want to really massage what's going on in there. In a subtle way, I've got a lot of information. So it's a bit technical, but it's part of the way that then when I'm shooting it, we're seeing hopefully ideally very close to what we have. And if even just the spit out of the Avid based on just what we had on set looks very close to the final episode now. So
Yeah. It is a beautiful looking episode and just a wonderful, wonderful bit of TV, that episode. The one that has just recently gone out, Gob Walks Into a Bar, that's the first time we really see Dr. Manhattan. We've seen little bits bits of it, but it's the sort of main first time we've properly seen him. How is it dealing with basically a giant blue man from your point of view? Because that's very difficult, I imagine, to handle when you've got a blue man that glows on set and you're having to light and deal with that.
Yeah, it's also something that we, you know, I think, well, like anything, so we sort of break down the process. And like, you know, part of being my role as cinematographer is to, you know, you work with the filmmakers and the directors of like what their intent is. And sometimes you're also helping them articulate maybe what they don't quite know how to articulate yet. In this case, Damon was for sure did not want, you know, and also in TV, for example, like, you know, in the end, the showrunner is sort of my ultimate director because they will post all the episodes. They will have the final cut and they will be doing the last rewrite on their words in the final edit. So for bigger questions always involve them for me because they're the ultimate arbiter of things. I mean, when I was on The Killing with Vina Sood, you know, I could go to her and say, hey, I've got this idea for something for Peter Sarsgaard's character. Should I be saving this for later? You know, knowing the story is going maybe this way. And she could say, oh, yes, good idea. Save that for later. In this case, Damon did not want he was determined not to have a completely CG Dr. Manhattan.
Right.
Because he was very afraid of the lack of control and like maybe being pinched for money and having a bad CG person. He really wanted to have an actor. He wanted to have someone that could look good in makeup, that could perform, that felt like they were in the real world. It wasn't going to be an always glowing Manhattan. And he also didn't know how much he was going to glow and how long and when. So we did a lot of extensive tests with Yaya in the makeup, both with sculpting in terms of shadow and all the tone, like how bright a blue. And then I lit him in various scenarios he might be in, like, you know, day interior, night interior, like had him walk through our living room set of the A-Bar house and the like. And we use that to guide the makeup choices and everything else. And I knew there might be some subtle like skin fixing and stuff later, which could be maybe like a very subtle digital manipulation is something that they could do, which I think they did in the end for some things. And I also knew that they would probably decide, you know, in post a bit, like as he's, you know, becoming more cognizant of his time when he's woken up in eight, like the whole idea is he's discombobulated because he's coming out of a position with no memory. So yeah. He shouldn't snap back to how he was before he was Cal. And in the script, you know, he's very distinctly named Cal Hatton, I think is how we called him in the script.
Right.
Because he's still partially Cal because he hasn't fully rebooted to his former self for the first, you know, 15-20 minutes. So he wanted to really be like Cal and really feel that is Cal and have him, the actor, be him as he was when he was Calvin when he took the form initially. And I knew they would change their mind of when the blue glow was happening. So off camera, when he knew he would glow when he first appeared, I would create some interactive light for that. And then later on, there were times that they decided they added stuff later, which I didn't offer any interactive light in because I didn't know we were going to do it then. So there's right. some CG lighting around in some of those scenes.
Okay.
But it's basically a lot of testing.
Yeah. You wouldn't know that some of that was CG lighting or what. It's very difficult to tell, but it comes off brilliantly, I think. I think it pulls together incredibly well.
I added light under the pool for him to make sure. So the pool would glow and that she would glow. So.
Yeah, it's wonderfully, wonderfully shot. It has been a beautiful series and I've really loved it.
Thanks so much.
We're coming up to you needed to get off. So I'll give you the last two questions that we always ask everybody.
Okay.
The first one is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess the issue for me is once I'm in production, I have to catch up on things, so I'm quite behind on a lot of things. What am I watching recently? I just started his Dark Materials.
Oh yes,
a bit of Rick and Morty season 4, which is hilarious. I just started watching Undone on Amazon.
Right, okay.
Which is actually a bit of a sort of a oddly Dr. Manhattan time jump or space jump. Oh, there's something else I'm trying to think what I just finished. Oh, I also just finished the Crown season 3, which I absolutely adored, which is beautifully done.
I
love that series from start to finish. And my friend Fabian worked on it. He shot episode 9, which is like an absolute masterpiece as well. And it's a really, I just love how Peter Morgan writes. I'm so impressed with the structure of his scenes and the way characters interact and the subtlety. It's really lovely.
Yeah, it's a brilliant series. And despite the fact they've changed the entire cast, you really don't notice. It just feels like the same show. It's great.
Yeah, after like an hour, you're like, I'm in. I understand the character.
And last question will be, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or future, which show would it be?
Oh boy. I don't know. I mean, I've worked on a lot of films too, so I'm kind of also keen to get back into films. I mean, I'm more attracted to the type of story than like a particular title necessarily. It's always exciting to be involved with something that has a bit of iconography to it, to, you know, to be sort of adapt. So, which is why Watchmen was so exciting. But I don't have any future TV shows. I mean, The Crown would be a dream to work on that for sure, because I love that show so much. And I felt the same way about Thrones when I got onto that.
Of course.
It's more like I love the films of Denis Villeneuve, you know, and a fellow Montrealer, but I'm more interested in the type of story and sort of more ethical dilemma and the way to get into something and the sort of efficiency of, you know, good visual storytelling to tell that. It's really not genre specific necessarily. So TV has some of that. A lot of TV now also is getting into stretching stories out over many, many episodes, sometimes too much. And what I really appreciate about Damon's work on Watchmen was the show moves at a very brisk clip, you know, and it keeps you guessing, and there's lots of turns and twists, and I think that's a beautiful thing about it. And keeps me on my toes. Every script is like, holy crap, it's a whole other movie to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Denis Villeneuve has got a Dune TV series coming to go along with his Dune movie, so, you know.
Yes, that's possible. Yeah, and I'm looking forward. I think he's a great choice for Dune. I think he's a really unique talent, the way he sort of tunes into the behavior of people, you know, and use that. They're the things that drive the story in a lot of things, what he's interested in the story. And I think that's really, really key. You know, it's not like you're being told things, you're sort of witnessing someone's behavior through a situation, and that is part of what the story is. So
anything else coming up that you can talk about? I know that usually isn't the case, because
I haven't got any big NDAs I can worry about. I just there's a film I shot last year which should be coming out shortly called American Woman, directed by a woman named Semi Chellis, who is one of the writers on Mad Men.
Cool.
And it's a really interesting film starring actually Hong Chau, who plays Lady True in this series, is actually one of the leads in it. And it's loosely based on the Patty Hearst kidnapping. It's a really good drama. So,
oh, cool.
So I'm very proud of that film.
Cool. I have to keep an eye out for that. I'm very much looking forward to the last episode as well. I'm very much looking forward to see how he wraps it up. So
great.
It's been lovely to talk to you. Hopefully I could talk to you for ages, but hopefully we can get you back on at some point in the future. It would be great.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. I'm happy to chat about this stuff anytime. It's always fun to help illuminate the craft and stuff. And thank you so much for the interest in our show and interest in what we do.
No problem. Hopefully we get another season of Watchmen. I know he's been a bit kind of umming and ahhing about it, but we'll see.
See.
It's lovely to talk to you. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye, David.
Bye. So that was the interview with Greg Middleton. Watchmen, of course, you can see on Sky Atlantic over here, or catch it on Now TV. Do go and watch it. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal show. Last episode goes out this week. In fact, we'll be out by the time this podcast airs, I haven't watched it yet. Have you watched it yet? I haven't.
No, not yet.
So we'll be going to watch that. And of course, if you want to hear more about Watchmen, me and Matt are doing a podcast over on Entertainment Talk. If you're starting to watch it, go and follow the podcast as well, and you can hear our thoughts on each episode afterwards. Go and check that out over on entertainmenttalk.org. Now we've got some highlights for the next few weeks on TV. As I mentioned early on, this is going to be the last podcast, or last main podcast of the year. I think I may put some interview podcasts over the next few weeks, but this is going to be the last sort of big news podcast for the year. So we're going to do highlights for the next few weeks, because there is lots of TV coming sort of between now and early January. So we'll kick off with Blood and Treasure, which we talked a little bit about last week. This is coming to Sci-Fi on the 19th of December at 2 a.m. I think it's then got a 9 p.m. repeat as well. This was one of those CBS summer shows, and if you know those CBS summer shows, they produce things like Zoo, so you know how utterly ridiculous and silly and over the top they are. It has got renewed for a second season though, so it sounds like it could be quite good fun. It's a globe-trotting adventure about a brilliant antiques expert and a cunning art thief who team up to catch a ruthless terrorist. So it's one of those really silly out there plot lines, but it sounds like it could be fun, silly stuff. But that's on Sci-Fi UK. It's called Blood and Treasure, and 19th of December for that, 2 a.m. and 9 p.m. for that. The Witcher finally lands after a lot of waiting around. We're finally getting The Witcher. That comes to Netflix on the 20th of December. I'm very, very much looking forward to this. You're doing a podcast for this as well, aren't you?
Yes, I'm trying something I've never actually tried before, which is a podcast marathon. But basically the plan is to get up as soon as possible on the Friday, which is, well, this Friday. Yeah. basically an episode for two episodes at a time. So one and two podcasts, three and four podcasts, five and six podcasts. podcasts, 7-8 podcasts. I don't know if I'll do that all in one day, because that's quite a lot to do in one day. But if I have some episodes left by the end of Friday, I'll obviously finish those off on Saturday. But so the thing that would be great to do is if you watched episodes 1 and 2, then listen to the podcast in between the two episodes, and we'll see how that goes. But hopefully, if the show's as good as I think it's going to be and as good as it looks, then it should be more fun than anything. So
yeah,
please join me on Friday for that. That would be very, very good. So and in the meantime, if you want to, because I've already done 3 podcasts. One is the preview and the other 2 are for the trailers.
Right. Okay.
All 3 of them are for all 3 of the trailers. So in the meantime, if you want to listen to the current Witcher coverage, I've got those up on the website as well. So that's going to be quite something to do.
Yes. Yeah. That's going to be a really interesting one to see if you can get away with that. Witcher 20th of December on Netflix. There's lots of good content coming to Netflix. Over on Sky One on the 21st of December at 2 p.m. you've got the second season of Moomin Valley, which sees the Moomins return once again. On the 24th, Christmas Eve, you have, as we mentioned earlier, Lost in Space season 2 arriving. So there's that on Christmas Eve. And if you've managed to binge through that on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, which is a random time to launch it, but Christmas Day on Amazon Prime, season 3 of This Is Us is arriving on Amazon Prime, which is great. And I'm looking forward to being able to binge my way through that. It's just a very strange day to drop it, but you know, fine. That's when you want to do it. It is out on Region 2 DVD at the moment. It has been dropped by Morpho, so it's not coming back onto Morpho. So it looks like Amazon is going to be the place for it now. But yes, it doesn't appear it's going to come back onto Morpho at all.
That might mean that you get next day episodes from now on, though, instead of waiting.
That is true.
Like 3 months or whatever it used to be.
They may change the deal, because at the moment the deal is for after it's aired on Morpho, and now it's not airing on Morpho. You may see it arrive earlier, but it is landing 25th of December for the season 3 of This Is Us. And I do really like that show. It's just a shame it's not really found an audience in the UK, unfortunately. Mm. Then over on Boxing Day, once you've binged through all that, you've got season 2 of You starting. So this is the wonderful, really dark, creepy drama about the obsessive that's stalking people. The second season moves the action to LA, and he's got like somebody else that he's apparently falling in love, in quotes, with. That's the second season of You. That's on 26th of December on Netflix. Then on the 29th, we have the return of the CBS procedural verse. So that's NCIS LA, Magnum PI, and Hawaii Five-O. That starts at 8 p.m. with Magnum, then 9 p.m. with Hawaii Five-O, and 10 p.m. for NCIS LA. They're all on Sky One from the 29th of December. 29th at 9 p.m., you've also got the Top Gear Christmas New Year special. That's Chris Harris, Paddy McGuinness, and Freddie Flintoff back doing a Top Gear traditional Christmas special. So
I forgot that Top Gear was still a thing.
Yes,
to be honest.
Yes. Yeah. And Amazon, of course, have got out the Grand Tour special as well. That is out at the moment. So there's lots of stuff if you're into your motor vehicles. On the 1st of January, we kick that off with Doctor Who. That is returning on the 1st of January at 6:55, which sees Jodie Whittaker back as the 13th Doctor. That is going to be followed a bit later on by Dracula. That is the Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss series. That's on the 1st of December at 9 p.m. Lots of things to watch on New Year's Day. Very much looking forward to those two. On the 2nd of January, we have the Deuce season 3 finally. That has arrived on Sky Atlantic. Sky Atlantic.
I think it ended about 2 months ago.
Yes, it has been a while. They've kind of kept hold of it. So, but yes, that is landing 2nd of January.
That's the final season as well. Yeah, final season. I can't remember if you just said that, but
yeah, it's just final season of that as well. Mm. 10 p.m. 2nd of January in Sky Atlantic for that. Doom Patrol, again, another one finally showing up somewhere. Season 1 of that comes to Stars Play on the 2nd of January, which is the Amazon add-on channel. There was talk of, I think they're releasing a Stars Play app, so you don't need like an Amazon subscription to do it. You can also get it on Apple TV as well. If you've got an Apple TV set up, you can add it as a channel to Apple TV. So there's lots of ways of getting Stars Play, and that's like $5.99 a month, and there's quite a lot of good stuff on there. It's got like Pennyworth on there. It's got a bunch of other things as well. I think they've got the one season of Deadly Class. There's a few other interesting bits and pieces on there, so it is worth looking at. Then on the 3rd of January, it's One Chicago, finally, on Sky Witness. So this was the news that we released last week, that Chicago, Med, Fire and PD are all winning on one day on the same channel.
One of them was on Channel 5, weren't they?
5 USA, that was PD.
5 USA. Right.
One of them was on Universal and one of them was on Sky Witness. So now they're all in the same place. 3rd of January for Chicago Med, that's at 8 p.m. and that's going to be followed at 9 p.m. by Chicago Fire and then 10 p.m. by Chicago PD, which means the crossovers will all match up as well.
Has Channel 5 got anything left?
I don't know.
They've lost a lot of shows over the last couple of years and I never really see much get put on there.
No, they are starting to do, they're starting to do a few more of original things themselves. They are starting, there's a few series they've started to make apparently. But no, I mean, there's an awful lot of trash on Channel 5, an awful lot of reality TV and like World's Biggest Dogs and things like that. I honestly, you do get the press release through from Channel 5 and I'm willing it to have something that I think will be really interesting on it, and 9 times out of 10 it's just a lot of reality TV trash and it just makes me weep. But
I'm only mentioning it because Channel 5 had one of these, so it's just another show that they've lost. That's all. So
but at least they're back all in one place, which is great for people who are a fan of the franchise. So they're all back. And NCIS season 17 of that also back on the 3rd of January, but that's over on Fox. And 3rd of January at 9 p.m. for NCIS season 17. And then on the 5th of January we have Call the Midwife season 9. There is a Christmas special on Christmas Day for Call the Midwife as well, so there is a Christmas special Christmas Day. Then on the 5th of January season 9 will start at 8 p.m. on BBC One for Call the Midwife. And that is everything we have for now until next year so far. So lots of stuff to keep you busy anyway.
There is a lot.
Over the Christmas period. I remember the days when you used to have nothing really to watch over Christmas other than the occasional Christmas special and when they put the Star Wars movies on TV, and that was about it. So yes, how things have changed. Lots and lots of stuff out there for you. Where can they find you for stuff, Matt?
On Twitter, eTalkUK, of course, the website entertainmenttalk.org. Please do join me Friday for The Witcher, of course, very highly anticipated. Whether you've played the game or not, or whatever your involvement with The Witcher, please come and check it out. Plus, it's also a first season, so it's a good kind of entry point for, it's not in season 5 or something like that. So good entry point for everybody. But hopefully everybody has a nice Christmas and a new year. There's certainly enough television on, isn't there?
Yes.
To keep everybody busy, plus all the stuff that's already out there. I know mostly what I'm going to be watching. So yes. Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy New Year. And we'll see what craziness 2020 brings us. Disney Plus is coming out next year, so that will be fun. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Speaking of which, I mean, in terms of cinema stuff, you've got Star Wars released this week as well.
That as well.
That's 19th as well. So yes, we're watching Star Wars. Lots and lots of things going on.
Something I forgot to mention, me and David to do a best and worst of 2019 podcast. I've started making my list of things already and we'll see how that turns out, because I've got a lot on some of my lists. But look out for that on Sunday as well. Hopefully that's all going pretty well. I've been looking forward to doing that for a while.
Yes, we're doing that over there as well. Obviously for us, we are going to be slowing down over the Christmas period, but there is still stuff going up and the air dates are still being updated. So you can come on and ask, and if you're looking for air dates for any US or UK TV shows, just come onto the website. There is still news going up at the moment. Go to geektown.co.uk for that. The awards, of course, are geektown.co.uk/awards. There is a Christmas list as well if you're looking specifically for individual one-off Christmas shows. That's geektown.co.uk/Christmas. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. You can leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram at Geektown UK. Have a great Christmas. Have a lovely new year. We will see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.